So we're looking at the fundamentals of practice, and I know some of you feel we're moving too fast through the fundamentals, and of course we are. But I don't know, I mean, we could spend a year on any one of these and just go over and over it. But really, there's a kind of growth that each of us can do as we return again and again to these themes. It's not as if you can do it all in one sitting, all in one talk, and in the couple of weeks we have to explore the topic. It does take a return to the topic, and then you'll see that you see it differently, you've hear it differently, because the whole consciousness will have settled out in a different kind of way. And I think it's important that these themes be brought up reoccurrently, but not necessarily elaborated on for long periods of time on the initial presentation. So we will revisit these. Some of you are still having trouble with some of my hurrying up, but I'm not actually hurrying at all. I feel that the necessary information for you to explore it on your own is being given, and I encourage you to do just that. What I'm most interested in these fundamentals doing for us, and I really want to emphasize this point, is that we start living the meditation. That it's not something we do, I'm a meditator, I sit 40 minutes a day. That's not a meditator. Meditator may, in the very earliest beginning of their practice, see themselves as a sitter because they repeatedly do just that over a period of time. And not to discourage sitting repeatedly or daily, it is important for most people, but that's not what it means to meditate. Meditation is to take the themes that are garnered within the practice as we sit. How is it that we are holding reality as we're sitting? Right? And bring those themes forward when we get out of sitting. And it's usually, that's the most destructive time is when we get out of sitting and go back to the logistics of our life. And the sitting was somehow, I don't know what we think of it, as sort of a temporary sanity that we can, a kind of an oasis that we can dip into, but really doesn't have much impact on our life. Wrong. It is our life, and we're learning how to move it forward through the sitting. The sitting isn't just about the sitting, it's also how to live. And the themes that we are bringing or evoking in these fundamentals are fundamentals for our life, to bring our life forward. And the most important fundamental, which I'm not talking about, but which is present in each subject, implied within each subject, is the love of truth. The love of truth. And that's a maturation as to whether you love. That's something I cannot teach you. That's why I don't bring it as a subject. Because that's a maturation of your own readiness to hear and your own experiential readiness to look at yourself with clarity and to admit what it is and how it is that we are living and whether what we are living with is an excess to what is really true about ourselves. So I can't teach the love of the truth. But it's implied in virtually every one of these lectures. You get to a point where you just, that's the most compelling reason that you practice, is that you are breaking through some barrier, distractibility, some objectability where you have not allowed yourself to enter before. And it often needs caution. I'm not hurrying you through any of this. As we mentioned in the denial talk, there is functional denial as well as dysfunctional denial. Functional denial is allowing the readiness to percolate in you so that you are ready for the subjects that you have delayed seeing. And dysfunctional denial is to know that you have that readiness and refuse to look anyway. And so you get a sense of what's back there. If you've been abused, for instance, I'm not rushing you at all into that, and I don't want you to. But if that emotional volatility is in you, and when you feel ready, it can be very helpful to, with skilled, under skilled supervision, for you to start fleshing out some of that experience in your own time. Okay? But just to know that that readiness, get a sense of one's readiness. Mostly what we get a sense of is our fear of that thing. And we think we're going to have the same fear of it that we did when it first arose, or when we first tried to see it some several years ago. Actually, what you'll find is that you have a very different relationship to many of these feared objects within our psyche. Because as the mind matures, it matures itself into a new orientation to the truth. And you can then more easily handle some of these more disturbing components that you might not think you're ready for now. So again, just to refresh ourselves and to look and to renew, because we have a love for the truth, that's why we do it. That's why we meditate. That's what moves our meditation forward. Nothing else, because it comes from the heart wanting its own completion, knowing and refusing to compromise its completion. And where we are unconscious of ourselves, we are incomplete. Doesn't that make sense? So we just methodically and in our own time march this thing forward. That's all. So we're living the fundamentals. And as we sit, we practice those fundamentals in the sitting, I hope. And we're going to be practicing one of the fundamentals we're going to be talking about now is bare attention. So bare attention is hopefully the very way we sit. And yet if you get up with unbared attention or confusion and refusing to really listen to the situation, to receive the situation, because that's what bare attention requires. It doesn't require configuring life, it requires receiving and listening to life. What has that 40-minute sitting been about for us? And to keep moving back into the living of the sitting, the living of the meditation. And I find that that's what is the greatest obstacle to most people's progress, is that they have the sitting and the philosophy of Buddhism, and it remains a conceptual overlay of their life so that it makes your life feel as if you are wiser and more knowledgeable about all this suffering that's going on. But we don't actually move the principles into the suffering itself. We try to adapt our way through the suffering, and that's not what this is called for, not what this calls for. But more of that, more about that at another talk. So this sense of bare attention is our new topic. And I love it because, what are you going to trust if you can't trust your bare attention? Right? Maybe one of you or a few of you are lucky enough to have someone who you trust conclusively as a friend or a mentor or someone. But in ourselves, if we want to see what is true, we have to have an absolute uncorruptibility. That's what's called for. And what is it in us? What is it in us that allows that absolute assurance that sees what it sees and knows what it sees? You see? So that no one can argue you away from the Dharma. It's not worth arguing about. It's like, I've seen it. Let's move on. Right? That's where someone who has a strong belief system will want to argue a lot, because what they're trying to do is convince you away from their own self-doubt. If they get you on their side, that's one less person to stimulate their doubting. But when you've seen something for yourself, you don't have to argue it at all. And you don't have to convert anyone to it. You can stand alone. And if 6 million people haven't seen it, looks okay. If the one other person after 6 million haven't and one person has, that's enough. It's not weighted like that. Maybe I ought to check out my insight. No, your insight is solid. Your insight knows what it sees. And the bare attention allows us to know with conclusion, with conclusiveness, with confidence, oh, okay, so this is it. This is it. That's what, it just grounds us in the fact of what we see. And, of course, when we're dishonest about what we see, bare attention shows us that too. It doesn't allow us to get out of a thing. When something is inconvenient to see, and you turn away from it, it sees all of that. It sees the inconvenience, it sees the aversion to the inconvenience, it sees the hiding, it sees all of that. So it just sits there in your consciousness, and then you can't get rid of it because you can't pretend you didn't see your own dishonesty. And so then you go, oh, you begrudgingly at some point haul yourself back to what you just saw. And again, it's not often very easy to do that, because often what we see is so aligned against what we want ourselves to be that we're in turmoil when that shows up. But it reveals the facts. That's the preciousness of this. That's why you have to love the truth to want to bear your attention. Your attention doesn't have to be bare. It can be full of opinions. Well, that's called normal attention. Right? Everyone has attention. It's just overloaded with your own opinions, your own conclusions, your own beliefs. And therefore, the bare attention can't really see it because it's so obscured by all the opinionations that we hold. But when you're sitting in Buddhism, when the practice is in you, you want to clear that out because you love the truth, you see. Without that, you don't care about clearing it out. But if you love the truth, you can't tolerate your conditioning as the final answer. It's not satisfying to come up with the same conclusion. It confirms you. That's what your conditioning does. It confirms where you've stood, what you know, and why you're so outraged. But it doesn't confirm the facts. And so we learn in this process is how, what is bare attention, you see? What is it? Because we flood bare attention with an overload of our conditioning, we have to learn how to access it. And that's why it seems like such a long process, because we have to learn how to bear our attention, the bearing of our attention, right? And that's not easy. Day one, in the beginning classes, I say, okay, focus in on your breath and know when you're thinking about your breath. That's different than being with your breath. What do you mean? The question comes up. What do you mean that's different than my breath? How is thinking different than what you're suggesting we do? See, it's so packed in there from our years of identifying with thought that we don't know that there's another reality outside of what the way thought colors it. And very slowly, for some of us, it takes a while for us to, and actually it's the entire growth of the practice, is to learn what pure attention is. And to free it completely from the sounds of the mind. And it can be done. It can be done. If it couldn't be done, there would be no such thing as freedom. But because it can be done, because we can hear the difference, know the difference between what the mind is saying and what reality is showing us, what attention is seeing, there is freedom. We may not want to face what attention is showing us because it, again, you know, it really reconfigures the whole alignment to life, everything about life. It is a completely different paradigm. And we can trust it. We know that it's valid because it was pure seeing. There was nobody, it wasn't a tool offered by someone. It wasn't a secondhand. It was developed and honed and seen. And you know when you're quiet, so you can trust the seeing. And you know when you're noisy, and you know when the seeing is being distorted by what we are thinking. So you don't trust that. But when you're quiet, when there is this pristine stillness, you know what you're seeing. Undisputable. It's cellular seeing, not eye seeing. Every cell holds this attention. It's not seen from the eye. And so, of course, the fundamentals are going to go through bare attention. How could they not? This is the essence of our practice. This is the essence of all spiritual practice. I'm not saying it's the only way. It's the only way if you want to go by the way of wisdom. But this is the way that we are guided in Buddhism. And it's done by Braille, not by manual. Completely gray, right? Like not knowing what to do, how to respond. Because the knowing how to respond, the action, it would be coming from conditioning if we had that built in. So it's learning what spontaneity really means. And we keep wanting to perform spontaneity, which is not spontaneity at all. So this bearing of attention, this bearing of attention, the bearing of our spirit. You see, this is the harder quality. Most of us are very comfortable or have a growing comfortableness with the psychological frame of our reference, and we certainly have to go through all of that, our neurotic and reactive tendencies, and re-look at those and begin to surrender some of the charge we have to life. But the far harder course that we have to take eventually is to bear our attention. Because bearing our attention is equivalent to bearing the heart. See, when the attention is bare, B-A-R-E, I have no protection of thought. Or it wouldn't be bare. It's quiet. It's quiet. And within that sensitivity, the mind has no control. It isn't in governance form. It isn't in control of that bearing. It's in control of thought, and it's held you accountable to your thinking, which is how it's maintained its governance. But when you want to bear attention, which is not thought driven, I hope we understand that, then thought has to be released in order for us to be able to see bare attention. And so really it's the open heart. It's another way of framing this same fundamental. And now there's an existential crisis because I don't know what to lead with when I'm feeling so raw and vulnerable. I'm just seeing facts here, and there are no protection from those facts. It's just fact. It's just... Some of us may remember the third foundation of mindfulness, when the Buddha has bared our attention through the first two foundations and leaves us just in the state of knowing what's arising, without any protection from what's arising. Now you can get a sense of how difficult coming to that state might be for some of us who have such fear within the different patterns and mind states that do arise. We have a whole history associated with each presentation of mind, and that history is often one based in fear. So to be unguarded, which means no way of protecting myself from it, by buffering myself with a story about it, I am left full exposure. And it seems to me that it's not trustworthy. What isn't trustworthy? The state of mind in an unbared way, when I'm just completely exposed to a state of mind, I don't feel... The sense of I doesn't feel that's trustworthy. So I would like a little relief here. I'd like to turn away. Although we just learned in the fundamental of the last talk that we turn towards the difficult. See? Escape route is now closed. See, that's a... You have to laugh here. Because it's a blind alley. I mean, this is the thing. It's not, this is where it takes us. If you love the truth, it's where it takes you. You see how we have to keep coming back to that? What's driving this? Why would I even want to go down that alley? Because you can't stand not to know what is true. And that's pure-heartedness. And pure-heartedness, the love of the truth, is what expresses itself when the attention is bare. So you're not without a compelling reason to look. It's a very compelling reason to look. But the conditioning, the history of us, says don't look. And the heart within us says do look. And so we have to work with that a little bit, to sort of sort things out so that we are comfortable enough with our ability to look. Some of us would like to know, how is that enough? That's a very important question. I remember many times in my practice having an emotion and thinking, how is just seeing this emotion, how is that enough? Doesn't feel like enough to me. It feels like I need to analyze it, know where it's come from, get a sense of its derivation, what it's done to me, you know, and then kind of line up all that information and knowledge, and then I never knew what the next step was, but I would at least have some allies here that I could have with me, and looking at this emotion. The emotion just by itself, just seeing... What's the point? How does that get rid of it? You see? Because that's how the self thinks. So that this is where the whole of the Dharma works cooperatively, where one of the fundamentals that we will talk about is wise view. And wise view says that what you want to do in life is to connect with things rather than to distance yourself from them. And that ultimately, if you maintain your meditation within that direction, the facts will be seen as friendly, and that they will be no longer a divided sense of separation between you and the facts and the antagonism and anger associated with you being aversive to the facts that you see. So this whole thing kind of See, every one of these fundamentals works in cooperation with the other fundamentals. So it's a little hard to talk about this fundamental without also talking about something I'll talk about probably in 12 or 15 weeks from now. But so I'm going to just give it a try. For most people who are lay practitioners, the entrance point for a number of years into their practice at any given time is their emotional life. That's what wakes them up. Oh, I'm feeling something here. I'm irritated. It's usually a difficult emotion. And that calls attention, an inward attention, to what's going on in me now, which is good. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But then the next thing is harder, and that is to do nothing with what you just saw. Because the training that we've all had is that now what I just saw, this emotion, is a problem for me. And a problem requires my effort to surmount it. So when we start working on an emotion as a problem, we have already made it into a divisive antagonist to the story, right? We're not interconnecting with it. We're trying to get rid of it, or to get over it, or to eliminate it. What bare attention does not offer any resources in trying to get over, away, or from something. Bare attention, in its essence, bridges that need and unifies the consciousness with what it is that's arising. The essence of the difficulty that made it a problem was the belief that I was separate from it. And what bare attention does is that it eliminates that belief. And then there is no problem. There was only a problem as I took a reactive stance to what it is that I was seeing. And from that reactive stance, I needed to do more than just look at it. I needed to do something about it. So I brought my analytical tools to bear, thinking that would solve the problem of the emotion. There are no problems in this world. So when I drop a bombshell, I just kind of like to... Okay, bombs away, and then you can send me emails if you so wish. Because some of you get very disturbed by those kinds of things, but just listen to it. A problem arises only in the field of separation. And separation is a false perception of life. Release the tension associated with the problem making, and the two things, the problem and the problem solver, come together. And that can only be done in the barest of attentions. We create the problem. We invest the meaning of what we're doing within the problem, and how awful this is that I'm having this emotion. Just seeing it begins to heal that rupture, that discord. It takes us back. You see, it's not meant. I mean, people often ask spiritual teachers, you know, how do I fix my relationship with this? We're really not much of a fixer, upper. We're not a Mr. Fix-It guy. You know, you're going to have to weigh in on your own life and make it work for yourself. What we do is we go to the basic rupture itself, where all the problems stem from. And we allow a reuniting so that one begins to sense how one's life could be based non-problematically so that problems never arise. When we offer an analysis of an emotion to the emotion. What we're really doing is trying to figure out why we have to have it in us. We're trying to justify its presence. It's in me because, well, I'm angry because, I mean, I had a terrible childhood, and if you'd had a childhood like mine, you'd be angry too. Plus, I never have the right boss, I never have the right spouse, all of these things have made me irritated and cynical about life, and that's the reason I have to feel this anger. So all of that, all of the analysis was to get us to a place where we now feel justified in having the anger arise within us. That's crazy making. Why not just feel it? Why justify having to feel it? You're going to have to feel it anyway. Just release all that, and let's go to the kernel of the whole thing. So you begin to see that the thoughts that are associated with an emotion are often thoughts that have to do with some healing attempt, some expression that the emotion is giving off in terms of thoughts, in terms of blaming for having the emotion or accusing or whatever it is, so that I won't have to own this emotion as mine. All of that is unacceptable to a Dharma mind. Because you see it, you see what you're doing. Bare attention again is seeing all of this behavior, this aversive behavior. And so instead of getting lost in all of those threads, it simply shuts up and faces exactly what's arising without commentary, without aversion. Okay, bring it on. And it does. Sometimes it comes on like a geyser. Because when we take the top of resistance off the pressure cooker, it all spews out. Sometimes it comes very methodical in easily handled experiences. I can't guarantee that it won't flood you. But you can always distract yourself from the flooding. You'll know you're doing it. But it's often a very good thing to do is to retreat back skillfully away from being flooded. Because you know your readiness to face this stuff, and sometimes you have to do it piecemeal, not all at once. And that's fine. Again, it's up to each of us to know our own resources. No teacher can tell you the right way for you to do it. But to remember that burying our attention is the maturation, the quieting of our attention. Seeing things without a story is another way of saying what I'm saying. And that when you see something without a story, that is what's called letting go. That's what's called surrender. When you see something from a story in which you're trying to tweak why it's there and rationalize its appearance, that's adapting to what you see. That's not surrendering to what you see. That's what the mind constantly does within us. What we have to learn to do is to simply see and let it go. When you see and let it go, you have no protection. You're not sure it's going to go. And that's why it feels like an existential crisis sometimes. But the beauty of bare attention is that it shines on everything equally. It shines on both sides of the equation, the pleasure and the unpleasant. It shines on what you're doing within each of those, the resistance to the unpleasant and the grasping after the pleasant. It shines on it. So because it shines on it, you know exactly what you're doing. And because you know exactly what you're doing, you can correct if you have love for the truth. If you have more love for your own survival, egoically, than for the truth, then that's what will survive. If you have more love for the truth than your egoic image, the truth will survive. And so you can see that it's the maturation of coming to loving what we're seeing. And that's one of the ways that we can live the meditation. Just the love of seeing what is there. The certainty that the facts that are presenting themselves are on our side. Our side meaning that they're in accompaniment towards a perfect alignment to reality. Not that they aren't troubling. Often facts are very troubling. And we begin to, the byproduct of bare attention is wisdom. When we see something, there's the knowing of what is being seen. And that understanding begins to broaden and expands. And then when you begin, if you've been using this thing off the cushion, you begin to see from wisdom with that understanding. Oh. And you feel the whole system, the cells in the body, quiet along with that understanding. What we're really talking about in bare attention is a deep acceptance of our humanity. Most of us, for a long period of time in the meditation, have not come to terms deeply with our humanity. There's still a tweaking of judgment, of reservation about ourselves, about our confidence, about our ability. Doubt flares. Bare attention is the surest path to that deep embrace of our humanity. Because the attention is like light. It's not weighing in on anything. The mind weighs in from its opinions, from its conditioning. But awareness never weighs in. All it ever does is reveals. It shines like light. Just this, just see it. You don't want to see it? That's fine. It won't push you to seeing it. It won't force you to seeing it. It won't pressure you or argue why you should see it. If you want to turn away, you turn away. The problem is, you just know you turned away. And you go, I don't care. And it sees that. And all of that is fake because you do care. And so, back you come. It doesn't let you go. There's no way out of this thing. And that's the love. You can hurry it along or make it run, move much more smoothly. Simply by surrendering to the fact at hand. I don't like that about myself, but there it is. And then there's this deep acceptance of humanity. Not that you become ideal. You don't, believe me. In any way, shape, or form. That's such an illusion that you will be empty, you won't have any argument, you'll never be in controversy, you'll be some kind of, I don't know, but I used to think that way. And you have to surrender all of that because your humanity is not like that at all. Promised. But what it is a beautiful perfection, a beautiful expression of your own uniqueness. And that you can't accept. Because awareness shows you that as well. And if you have this thought, which our tradition sometimes does, that when you get to a certain place, that certain things will never arise. Anger will never arise in me again when I get to a certain, you know, I'll never have fear again. Just wait. But more and more, what holds our attention is not the expression and the condemnation of that expression, but the beauty and the formlessness of the attention itself. How it begins to bring in something that my judgment never could. How it begins to heal the rift so long endured. The rift between all things. And it does it with the gentleness of ways. It does it within presence. It does it within the gentleness of bare attention, which was never, ever a force of compulsion. A simple invitation to see. Or not, completely up to us. Completely. And so, somewhere in the stirring of all that, when you have a tool that you can trust, that you can count on, that's incorruptible, as long as it's bare, it's incorruptible. And the exposure of the heart with its yearning to know the truth, which accompanies that tool, and the willingness to bear it ever so more. And what does bearing mean? It means simply no longer to invest in the confusing overlay of thinking between it and what is being seen. Because thought never tells you the truth about what the reality is. It gives you a simulated substitute for that truth. And once you see that the words will never take you there, you're not interested in words any longer at all. And that is known through bare attention. That's the wisdom. That's the guidance system. And to accompany that with the surrender of what is seen and the confidence of our own knowing and the certainty and reliability of what is seen and the unshakability, no matter how many people in your family or around you are arguing that you're doing the devil's work, doesn't matter a bit. You don't even argue it. Okay. Can we sit for a minute or two? Let us sit with bare attention. So that we know the thoughts we are bringing forth. How we are covering this reality. Letting the choir uplift. Somehow it has a perfect uplift. Okay, all. If there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to respond. Yes.
I'd like to know a distinction between feeling and emotion. For me, emotion has a story, but feeling is a sensation in the body. So let's say I walk by someone torturing a bird, my body just goes like that. It's like a sadness that comes. So their attention for me would be experiencing and noticing and being with that. When you talk about just seeing it, I guess the feeling is more like an observation and an existence. And that seems like you could not feel the feeling, and that would be a danger.
Okay, so the question, did everybody hear that? The question has to do with a difference between feeling and emotion, and it seems to me that bare attention feels like a distancing or a detachment from what is being seen. But in order to be detached, there has to be two things. There has to be the emotion and the reaction of the within the person of what it's seeing. Bare attention doesn't hold either one of those separate from the other. Bare attention is not coming from the person. The pause was for drama. It is and does not come, awareness does not come from your mind. If it did, it would be corruptible, would it not? Because whatever you were doing, you didn't like what you had just seen, you'd be pulling back. And you wouldn't even know you were pulling back, and you'd have no way of even stopping that process. But bare attention is not governed by the sense of you. In fact, bare attention sees the sense of you as part of the complete picture of what you just reacted to. It sees the object, it sees the aversion, and it sees the sense of you pulling back in a safe place. This space in the room, let us use it analogously to bare attention. It's not demanding anything from you, is it? It's not putting any pressure on you to sit in one seat as opposed to another. And now let's say this space in the room was also aware, so that whatever you did, you were being held within awareness. Now you could walk around and be known no matter what you were doing. And if you had a reaction to something, you pull back, awareness would see the whole thing. It would see what just transpired, and it would see you, the formation of you, transpiring in an aversive state. Listen, you don't exist except as a thought in your own mind. You can see yourself as clearly as you can see any thought when you're willing to see. It's the last holdover because it's the most conditioned thought we have, the thought of I. But it's simply another thought with a memory that arises within the space of this room. In Buddhism, a feeling is different than an emotion. A feeling is a based way that we are set to act on something because we've conditioned a certain tone of feeling into something. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and a neutral tone is conditioned into what it is that we've learned to associate with certain objects. Spinach, I don't like it, it's unpleasant. That's what in Buddhism is called a feeling. Now we spent many months talking about how the self was formed from a feeling, how it took this base sense of aversion or attraction, either one, or completely delusionary, but let's say it's aversion, and how once this thing steps back from something, and a story from a memory forms around it, the story embellishes the unpleasant to make it into an object that is disdainful or whatever it is that we... Then the emotion comes from that embodied memory with story included from the basic feeling tone that was there to begin with. And now we are full-blown sense of I. Never in any of that were you there that preceding that fact. You arose from that process. Don't make yourself something or you'll fall, make this into a psychology. This is not a psychological transformation. It is a transformation where we change paradigms. We step out of ourselves. Yes, sir. Okay, so in the beginning, the question is bare attention and awareness. Are they the same, different? I appreciate the question. In the beginning, our bare attention is like a straw. You know, it's like a little small thing that you see through and you're just trying to activate something that allows you to pay attention. And we call it mindfulness, and it feels very governed by the sense of I. So I'm being present to my breath, I'm now being present to my sense of physical sensations, I'm being present to this, I'm being present to that. And it feels also very much under our control. And that's awareness, but it's not bare, it's got a lot of stuff back there. It's got opinions going on, a lot of judgment, a lot of thought, and it's all being held by the central delusionary center called me. All right, so all of that, as we relax to everything that we're seeing, to the sense of who it is that's seeing, to what it is that's seeing, there's a deep sense of psychic release of tension around everything. The straw, which first started out as a very narrow opening, now starts expanding in its breadth and what it can see. Because we are no longer tense and tight about problematically seeing something that we don't want to see. So as that psychic release happens, the space of awareness opens up. Okay? So now the attention is getting barer, if that's a word, less cumbersome. Right? And as it begins to become less cumbersome, it opens up to whatever it is that assumed the place of the controller of the attention. Eventually it opens up to the sense of you yourself and what you are is seen by awareness. The attention is not coming from any person now as being a thought, an emotion, and a memory. You see that. Once you see that irreversibly, the game's over. The game's over in claiming a reference to who it is that's being aware. Once that happens, a new psychic relaxation happens and it opens up even wider. Now is space around you so that you are seeing 360. That's pure witnessing, some schools call it, because it's no longer under your control. That's what I mean by bare attention. Okay? So it's just semantics, really, but all along the way, awareness is opening up beyond thought, beyond its reactivity, and is getting cleaner as it does so. Yes, sir.
If two people are successfully focusing their attention on something and are free from the distortions that each of them has, is the truth that they see the same?
You know, it's interesting, but I don't know how many of you are familiar with Brian Greene, a physicist. He shows conclusively in the book I'm reading, but don't ask me to explain it. See, as you move, I'm bringing in science here. As you move, you actually, time slows for you in movement. If you move very fast, it slows noticeably. If you move a little, it slows a little. But in any movement, there is some slowing of time. Right? Which means that time is being delayed for the person in movement more than it is for the person who is in complete stationary. which means that the moment they're experiencing are different from each other. It's a different present. You see? So I don't know how to answer your question, because I have never seen from someone else's vantage point. But I do know that what I see can be very bare. And that I'm also able to communicate to your perception, whatever it may be, or however slowed or fast it may be, to your present, the same laws that govern mine, I can assume govern yours. I know govern yours, regardless of whether what presence you're seeing. And therefore, you will see the same truths. You may not see them at the same time I see them. I don't know about that. But you'll see, because reality is not based, one person's reality is not based, oh, I see separation is true. Another piece says, I see emptiness is true. That's not, there's only one true reality that is perceived through bare attention. But not, maybe not simultaneously, I don't know. You see what I'm saying? I don't, so your question was one that threw me off a little bit, but basically I did the best I could. Okay. So thank you all very much.